All right, welcome back to the Deep Dive. Today, we're going to be taking a pretty fascinating look at a case that really highlights the kind of complex relationship between U.S. law and the international stage.
Yeah, it's definitely a case that still has ripples today in how we think about jurisdiction, terrorism, and at least the whole idea of globalization in a legal sense.
It's a dense one, but it's super important, especially if you're trying to understand how far American legal power can actually reach. And the case we're talking about is United States versus Yunus.
Right. And I think a lot of people might find it surprising, you know, that a case from the mid-80s is still so relevant. But it really sets some precedents that are, you know, they're kind of unavoidable when we talk about international security challenges today.
For sure. So for our listeners who maybe haven't encountered this case before, let's set the scene a bit. It all starts back in 1985 with a pretty terrifying incident. A Jordanian Airlines flight gets hijacked in Beirut.
Yeah. And to make matters worse, you know, you have two American citizens on board. So right away you have this this immediate impact on U.S. interests. And, you know, just think about the pressure to respond in some way.
Absolutely. And at the center of all of this is Fawaz Yunus. He was a Lebanese national and the alleged leader of the hijackers.
Right. So fast forward a couple of years, you know, the FBI is on the case and, well, they end up luring Yunus into international waters off the coast of Cyprus. And they arrest him in this kind of elaborate sting operation.
Sounds like something out of a movie. But, you know, thinking about the legal side of things, you know, it begs the question, does a U.S. court actually have the power to put a foreign national on trial for something that happened in another country?
Yeah, and that's the real core issue here, right? It's not just about the facts of the hijacking, but about the limits of U.S. law, especially when you're dealing with a global context.
So let's unpack that a bit. You know, what were the actual legal arguments that the U.S. government used to justify prosecuting Yunus?
Well, there were two main statutes that they relied on. First, you have the Hostage Taking Act. And what's interesting about this is that it doesn't just apply if the hostage is American. It also applies if the hostage taker is a U.S. national. So right away, because you had those American passengers on the plane, this act kind of kicks in.
So it's not just about protecting Americans abroad. It's also about holding American citizens accountable, even for crimes committed in other countries.
Right, exactly. And then you have the second statute, the Anti-Hijacking Act. And this one basically says that if someone hijacked a plane and they're later found in the U.S., they can be prosecuted here. And of course, that was the case with Yunus after they brought him back.
So on the surface, these laws seem to cover the situation. But Yunus's lawyers, they didn't just sit back and accept this, did they?
Oh, not at all. They argued pretty vehemently that, you know, the U.S. was way overstepping its bounds, you know, violating international law and interfering with the sovereignty of other nations. You know, the idea that America could just swoop in and prosecute anyone anywhere, it raised a lot of concerns.
Yeah, it's that whole world police image, right? So how did the U.S. courts address those concerns, you know, the potential conflict with international law?
They actually leaned on a couple of pretty established principles of international law. And the first one is called the universal principle. And this basically says that, you know, there are certain crimes that are so horrific, like piracy or in this case, hijacking, that any nation can prosecute the people responsible, regardless of where it happened or who was involved. It's kind of a recognition that some crimes are just so universally condemned that they're everyone's problem, not just the country where they occurred.
So it's not just about American interests. It's about a global interest in stopping certain kinds of really bad acts.
Exactly. And then the second principle is called the passive personal principle. And this one focuses on protecting the victims. It basically says that a country can prosecute crimes committed against its own citizens, even if those crimes happen in another country. So again, because you had American passengers on that flight, the U.S. could argue that it had the right to step in and seek justice for its own people.
Okay, so it's about protecting your own citizens, even when they're abroad. Now, wasn't there also some kind of international treaty that was relevant to all of this?
Yeah, there's the Hague Convention for the Suppression of Unlawful Seizure of Aircraft. And this convention, it includes what's called an extradite or prosecute mandate.
Mm.
Basically, if a country has someone in custody who's accused of hijacking, they either have to extradite them to another country that wants to prosecute them, or they have to prosecute the person themselves. And the U.S. used this to say, look, We're not just acting on our own here. We're actually fulfilling our obligations under this international agreement.
So they're trying to show that they're not just some rogue nation, but that they're acting within the framework of international law.
Right, and that's an important point. But there's also this really crucial distinction that comes up in the case, and it has to do with the relationship between international law and domestic law in the U.S. You know, the court basically said that unless a treaty or a principle of international law is self-executing, meaning it automatically becomes part of U.S. law without Congress having to do anything, then the laws passed by Congress actually take priority.
Wait, so what does self-executing actually mean in practice?
Basically, it means that the treaty or the principle of international law is directly enforceable in U.S. courts without needing any additional action from Congress. But in the Yunus case, the court basically said that the relevant principles of international law about jurisdiction, they weren't self-executing. So the Hostage Taking Act and the Anti-Hijacking Act, you know, those were the laws that really mattered because they represented the clear will of Congress. And that's a, you know, a really fundamental point when you're thinking about how international law gets applied in the U.S.
Gotcha. So despite all the arguments about international law and sovereignty, the U.S. court ultimately said, look, our domestic laws give us the authority to prosecute Yunus.
Exactly.
Now, let's move on to another pretty controversial aspect of the case, which is how Yunus was actually apprehended. I mean, his lawyers argued that he was essentially kidnapped.
Right. They claimed that, you know, luring him onto that yacht in international waters was a blatant violation of his rights and that the whole trial should be thrown out because of that. But the problem for them was that U.S. courts follow this longstanding principle called the Kerr-Frisbee Doctrine.
Kerr-Frisbee, huh? That's a mouthful. So what does that doctrine actually say?
Well, it basically says that U.S. courts can try a defendant regardless of how they were brought before the court, even if it was through, you know, straight up abduction from another country. The idea is that the court should focus on whether the person is guilty or not, not on the methods used to get them there.
Wow. So it's like, as long as you're in the courtroom, it doesn't matter how you got there. That seems like it could lead to some pretty questionable practices.
Yeah, it's definitely a doctrine that's been criticized over the years.
Mm-hmm.
And in the Yunus case, his lawyers tried to use this argument. You know, they said the FBI's actions were so outrageous, so beyond the pale, that it should be an exception to the Kerr-Frisbee rule.
So did the court buy that argument?
Well, the court acknowledged that, yeah, there could be some extreme cases where the government's conduct is so bad that it would invalidate the trial. But they ultimately decided that what the FBI did, while definitely sneaky and, you know, pushing the boundaries, it wasn't so shocking that it violated Yunus's due process rights. You know, basically, they said the deception was bad, but not bad enough to throw out the whole case.
Interesting. So it's like there's a line somewhere, but the FBI didn't cross it in this case.
Right. And it shows you this tension that exists, you know, between wanting to hold people accountable for serious crimes and also upholding these international norms about, you know, respecting the sovereignty of other countries.
For sure. Now, there was another argument that Yunus's lawyers made, and it had to do with the military's involvement in his arrest. Specifically, they claimed that it violated the Posse Comitatus Act.
Yeah, the Posse Comitatus Act is this federal law that basically says the U.S. military can't be used for domestic law enforcement. You know, it's about keeping the military out of civilian policing. And Yunus's lawyers said that by transporting him back to the U.S., the Navy was essentially acting as law enforcement.
So they're saying the military overstepped its role.
Right. But there were a couple of important points that kind of undermine that argument. First, the Posse Comitatus Act. It specifically applies to the Army and the Air Force, not to the Navy or the Marines. So technically, the Navy wasn't even covered by the act in this case.
Oh, so right off the bat, there's a problem with that argument.
Exactly. But even if the act had applied to the Navy, the court also made this distinction between, you know, direct active participation by the military and law enforcement and what they called passive assistance. And they said that the Navy's role was really just about transport. You know, they weren't involved in the actual arrest or investigation. So the court basically said, look, this was just passive assistance, not direct involvement in law enforcement. And that helped to set some boundaries around when and how the military can be used in these kinds of international operations.
It's all about the nuances, right?
Yeah, for sure.
Now, I also remember reading that Yunus tried to get access to some classified intelligence during the trial.
Right. He invoked something called the Classified Information Procedures Act, or CPIA. This act basically outlines how classified information is handled in criminal cases. You know, it's trying to balance the need to protect national security with the defendant's right to a fair trial.
That sounds like a tough balancing act. So how did the court handle that?
Well, under SIPA, the judge can do what's called an in-camera review. Basically, the judge looks at the classified documents privately to see if there's anything in there that could help the defendant's case.
Yeah.
You know, anything that could cast doubt on their guilt.
So it's like a secret review by the judge to see if there's any crucial information hidden in those classified documents.
Exactly. And in Eunice's case, the judge reviewed everything and decided that there wasn't any information that would have helped his defense. And this, you know, it highlights the challenges that defendants face when they're dealing with classified information. It's hard to argue that you've been denied a fair trial when you don't even know what the government is keeping secret.
For sure. It seems like a huge uphill battle. Okay, so shifting gears a bit, one of Eunice's main defenses at trial was that he was just following orders from the Amal militia in Lebanon. How did that play out?
Yeah, that gets into the whole idea of obedience to military orders as a defense. Eunice basically said, look, I was just a soldier following orders from my superiors. But the court had to figure out whether the Amal militia even qualified as a military organization in the legal sense.
So it's not enough to just say, I was following orders. You have to be following orders from a legitimate military authority.
Right. And to decide that, the court looked to the Geneva Conventions, which are these international treaties that set the rules for warfare. And the Geneva Conventions, they lay out some criteria for what makes a group a legitimate military force. Things like, you know, do they have a clear chain of command? Do they wear uniforms that distinguish them from civilians? Do they follow the laws of war?
So it's about being organized, identifiable, and following the rules of engagement.
Exactly. And in the end, Eunice's defense failed on this point, because the court found that the Amal militia, they didn't meet all the criteria. And one of the key things they were missing was fixed and distinctive insignia. Basically, they didn't have clear markings that identify them as soldiers.
Wow, so it all came down to the uniforms.
Well, it was more than just the uniforms. But it does show you how specific these legal definitions can be, even in these messy situations involving groups that aren't traditional armies.
Makes sense. Now, there was another interesting point about the jury instructions, and it had to do with the whole idea of criminal intent.
Oh, right. The defense argued that the prosecution had to prove that Eunice had some specific malicious motive beyond just the act of hijacking the plane. You know, like he had to have some ulterior motive or evil purpose. But the court rejected that argument. They said that hijacking a plane and taking hostages is inherently wrong, and that the act itself is enough to establish criminal intent. You don't need to prove some extra layer of evil on top of that.
So basically, the act speaks for itself. It's so inherently wrong that the intent is kind of built in.
Exactly. And that was a significant point in the case.
All right. So as we wrap up here, it's clear that United States versus Eunice was a landmark case. Can you just sum up for us why it's still so important today, especially for those studying law?
Well, I think the biggest takeaway is that it established this precedent for the U.S. to go after people for international terrorism, even if it happens outside U.S. borders. And it also really cemented the idea that U.S. law can have a really broad reach, especially when American citizens are involved.
Absolutely. And for our listeners who are, you know, digging into the intricacies of law, what are some of the key things to remember from this case?
Well, you know, really understanding the ins and outs of jurisdiction is huge, especially when you're dealing with international cases. And then the whole interplay between U.S. law and international law, that's crucial. And don't forget about those controversial doctrines like Kerr Frisbee and the Posse Comitatus Act. Understanding its limits is key. And then, of course, you know, the whole issue of classified information, how that gets handled in court. It's all incredibly important stuff.
Tons of stuff to unpack. But I think one of the most fascinating things about this case is that, you know, the world is constantly changing. Terrorism is evolving. So how do you think the legal principles from Eunice might be challenged or reinterpreted in the future, you know, as we face new threats and new kinds of conflicts? It's something worth thinking about.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. It's a case that keeps on giving in terms of things to think about.
Thanks for joining us today on The Deep Dive.